TV.
On the radio.
Roll it there, cadet.
Hey, how you doing?
Bazinga.
Well, I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
One for everybody in the audience.
It's going to be legendary.
You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Sweetheart, Ginny asked you what class you're in.
Freshman.
My daughter Caitlin's a freshman, and Danny is in 11th grade.
What are their zodiac signs?
He's a Libra.
Uncommitted, inconclusive, evasive.
It is your astrology. I don't believe in all that.
Frasier's obsessed with astrological signs. Aren't you, babe?
What about Caitlin?
Sorry?
My sign is Caitlin.
Aries. Is that any better?
I have the new commander.
All depends on her rising sign.
Fisher's a bit on the relentless side.
That's We Are Who We Are. It's you can see it on Tuesdays at 11:15 on BBC Two. James Dempsey joins us once again. Afternoon, James. This is this kind of coming of age fair?
Yes, definitely. So I think the big kind of the big name attached to it is, and my Italian is not great, so bear with me, it's Luca Guadagnino, who is the director of Call Me By Your Name, amongst other kind of big Italian movies, I Am Love being one. Another kind of big Euro fair you might have heard of, shall we say. And this is completely and utterly his idea. And it's even billed in the opening credits as Luca Guadagnino's We Are Who We Are.
Oh, right. Okay.
Which I don't know if that even sets the tone for like it being already a bit self-worshipping. But yeah, it's a coming of age fair set in a US Army base in 2016. And it ostensibly surrounds these two teenage characters. One of them is Frasier. He's played by Jack Dylan Grazer, who people would know from the two recent It movies. And then Caitlin, who is played by Jordan Christine Siemens, who I don't think they would know. And basically, the pair of them are these army brats in the sense that they're, you know, their family are career soldiers. They're growing up on this army base, but they're both somewhat outsiders. And it opens with Frasier arriving with his mother, who's taking over as the colonel of the entire base. She's played by Chloe Sevigny, and his other mother, played by Alice Braga. And he arrives on the base and is immediately an outsider, and he's a bit odd and strange in even how he behaves. And he in the first episode, the story is told entirely from his perspective, and he begins this sort of friendship with the daughter who we heard mentioned in the clip there, Caitlin. And the second episode follows the exact same events, but entirely from her perspective. And we get a greater understanding of who she is and who she is developing as a person and who Frasier is and who he is developing as a person. And that's all fine, right? For me, I got the strong sense that this was something that I'm supposed to like because it's important, but which is actually like it's just fine, to be honest with you. Now, if you liked Call Me By Your Name, of which many, many, many people did, it does have Luca Guadagnino's sense of style and pacing in the sense that it looks really nice despite being quite ordinary. It's shot very pretty and it makes Italy look fantastic, and you'll be pining for the days of like a summer holiday, you know, in Italy where you're in a piazza drinking coffee or eating pizza. And it manages to convey this kind of summertime sense of heat and teenageness and hormones and uncertain identities and all that quite well. But then it keeps going and there's another episode and there's another episode and there's another episode. My biggest problem with it was I just didn't really like the main character. Frasier is obviously, he's not supposed to be liked, but he's not even really remotely likable in any way that I could find. And I didn't warm to him at all. He has these occasional moments of extreme, like almost violence towards one of his mothers that comes completely out of absolutely nowhere. And then doesn't really serve the plot in any other kind of way, except for this strange shock value. Other than that, they've done this strange thing where it's set in 2016 and there are these allusions to the election between Trump and Clinton. And at one point, a couple of Make America Great Again caps arrive. But other than that, it doesn't really have anything else to say about the state of American politics or the outcome of that election, or you know, there's no payoff, certainly not in the four episodes I've seen anyway. So for me, it was kind of like if you ever went to the IFI on Eustace Street in Temple Bar and watched an Italian movie, which the Irish Times told you was a 5-star movie, and you sort of sat down and watched it and it was a 3-star movie, and you just kind of thought, okay, this wasn't for me, but I get that it was pretty. That's what this is for me.
Right, okay. And as I understand it, they were planning to shoot it on an actual army base, but then the army withdrew.
Yeah, so they had approached the US Army to shoot specifically on a base in Italy. And originally the US Army said, absolutely, yeah, you can have access to the base. And then they read some of the scripts. And I guess because the scripts take a somewhat critical look at the army as an institution, and certainly war as a thing as well. But because I think the main aspect of the show is about finding sexual identity, really, in terms of both gender and sexuality, there's a lot that the army was not allowed to be supporting of during the Trump administration anyway, as to whether or not that will change remains to be seen. But they immediately said no, and then HBO ended up just building a set beside the real army base and shooting basically on the other side of the fence, from my understanding.
Okay. And is that like the two moms aspect to the story, or other stuff, do you suspect?
I'm not sure about the two mothers, but as I said, this is about teenagers finding themselves. Yeah. And our two main characters are the kinds of teenagers that I think do not exist in the real world, insofar as, you know, they're having these amazing, hazy, dreamlike summer times where they're, you know, floating in boats and reading Walt Whitman and talking about philosophy.
Yeah.
And not looking at their phones, which, you know, is just really not reminiscent of any teenager I've met in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's a kind of, yeah, actually, that is an increasing thing you're seeing in the scripts for, if you've read much Don DeLillo, the American writer, but on occasion, he has a child in some of his books, and the children, like, would be 10, all speak like they're 35-year-old philosophy PhDs, you know. Like, you've never met a child, have you, really? Anyway, that's just a bugbear of mine, anyway. Right, okay, so this is more atmospheric than compelling.
Well, I certainly haven't found the first four episodes that compelling, but there is something watchable about it, in the sense that, like, it is beautifully shot despite being very plain and ordinary. There's a great score to it. There are moments, these kind of great lingering moments, where you're kind of just waiting for something to happen and then it never does. But then in the kind of few moments where a dramatic punch does come along, it kind of grabs your attention back. So I'm more on the fence about it, I think, than other criticism I've read about it. But it's just, it just hasn't really got its hooks into me yet.
Right, a couple of bits of TV news. And Dave Chappelle has shown his awesome power, it seems.
So this is just very odd, right? So I mean, I've never seen Chappelle's show, which is his early 2000s sketch show, but I know it by reputation because it is very infamous for being kind of very, very controversial. And the rights to it are owned by Viacom CBS. And when it ended very suddenly. And he went in, not quite into hiding, but he sort of disappeared from public view for a while. And he came back, you know, maybe 5 years ago, I'd say, probably, with this Netflix special. And Netflix was going to be his new home. And then 3 weeks ago, I think only in the US, I don't know if it was in the UK, Ireland, Netflix or not. But in the US, Chappelle's show had been bought by Netflix and was up and running on the streamer. But he went on this long 18-minute rant on Instagram, telling all of his fans not to watch it because he claims Viacom CBS have never paid him for the streaming rights to his show, despite owning the rights to it. They never have given him any money for any streaming. So when they sold this to Netflix, he didn't even know that. And he asked people specifically not to watch it. And 3 weeks after posting it, Netflix actually just pulled it from their network altogether. And you can't now watch it. And it kind of remains to be seen if the other streamers that are showing it will follow suit or not.
Right. That's extraordinary, though, that he would have that much power. Plus, also an extraordinary thing, if you're a fan of mine, don't watch my TV show.
Yeah, true. Yeah. We actually said you can watch it only after I give you permission, basically. until you hear me saying it's safe to watch it, then don't watch it because I haven't been paid yet.
And the next piece of news, actually, when I first read it, I thought this must be a sketch of some sort or a Waterford Whispers type thing. But apparently Fox News is entering the world of TV Christmas movies. A very, very, very white Christmas. Santa comes back and gives Trump the election. The jokes write themselves. What are they actually doing?
So basically, yeah, like there's some weeks I'm scraping the bottom of the barrel for TV news during COVID, but this was like a real gem. So basically, I didn't know that Fox News has this thing called Fox Nation, which is, they bill it as Netflix for conservatives. They set up their own streamer. I mean, it's very de rigueur to set up a streamer in 2020, 2019, etc. But it is only, as far as I can tell, filled with opinion shows and news broadcasts and merchandising opportunities for Fox, you know, apparel, etc. But basically, they have now bought the rights to Christmas in the Rockies, which is a like made for TV Christmas movie. And their plan is to invest more money into the kind of burgeoning war of Christmas movies that's taking place, particularly on US TV. So there are channels that specialize almost uniquely in this, the Hallmark Channel being one of them. I mean, every year they release a slate of about 30 to 40 Christmas movies, which ostensibly all have exactly the same plot, right? You know, uptight woman learns the error of her ways and falls in love with Christmas. But this time around, it's about a woman named Katie Jolly, whose family's Jolly Lumber Mill, she takes it over despite harboring a desire to move to New York, and now must save the business while also taking part in a lumberjack competition. And I don't know quite how Christmas is involved, but I presume there's some snow and it was filmed in Canada, so everyone was probably a bit cold. And the other thing about it is Fox and Friends, which is kind of the, you know, the very infamous Fox kind of magazine show, it looks a bit like, two of its anchors, Steve Doocy and Ainsley Earhart, are making cameos in this. And originally they were set to fly to Canada to film actually on the set, but because of COVID they couldn't. So instead they are doing like a mock Fox and Friends broadcast within the movie, and will be playing themselves doing their own job within the movie to, you know, sell the whole product of Fox Nation.
Right. But their job is to just suck up to Trump. It's hard to know how they'll do that job. I suppose we'll find out. Bizarre. Right. We'll move on to our second show of the day. It's called The Pack. Here's a clip.
He's basically my everything.
I would be really lonely without her.
I'm more happy and cheerful when I have him with me.
We're going to take 12 dogs and their partners. They'll travel to beautiful countries and compete in epic challenges. Right, Luz?
Bye! Hey, they're behind us. This way, guys, come on!
Go. This is just a life that I thought I'd never have, especially with a dog by my side.
Right, that's The Pack. All 10 episodes of season 1 are streaming now on Amazon Prime Video. I think that particular clip there gave some idea of what it's about. The dogs, though, James, are they these like working dogs, or are they like hypoallergenic little mutt-type dogs that people carry in their bags?
They're a bit of a broad mix. So you get everything from like a literal professional model dog, who's Charlie, who's been on various TV shows and ad campaigns, to a dog that was rescued when, you know, from the street when this guy was walking by, and the owner was basically going to put it down, and he overheard a conversation and took it from the other owner. So they're an absolute mixed bag. It's a very strange show, this. It comes from a man named Jay Beanstock, who's a kind of big producer on Survivor and The Voice. So he is a like American honcho when it comes to this kind of reality TV fare. And it is reality TV competition. And the premise is kind of interesting because, you know, who doesn't like watching dogs do silly things on TV? That's like perfect television. And they basically bring together 12 human participants and their dog, you know, sidekick. And they take part in various challenges. And at the end, they're going to win a $500,000 prize and then $250,000 donated to the charity, the animal charity of their choice. And then a further $250,000 is donated along the way in each country that they go to, because the scale of this production is insane. They begin in LA with a kind of, like, if you've seen La La Land, where the opening of La La Land, they're on the freeway and they've blocked all the, you know, right, there's traffic. They open with a kind of riff on that, including you know, cameos by Denise Richards and Dennis Rodman, who probably aren't that expensive to get, but still cost a bit of money. Then they go from LA to Mexico City, then Costa Rica, then Vienna, then Florence, the Swiss Alps, Paris, London, and then back to the US, and they finish off in Utah. So they're this, like, whistle-stop tour of the world. And then each of the, and that even sounds like it's going to be fun, right? But it's, no, it's not. And then they get to the challenges, and the challenges are so laborious, like they have to, you know, dig a hole and then solve a puzzle and then run around and then find a boat and then get, you know, traverse the lake and then go up the stairs and then zip rope down. They have to do 10 million things in every single challenge. And they're, I mean, I've never seen a show that is so more produced than it needs to be than this one, because it actually, at 60 minutes for each episode, it really, there's a lot of, you know, fat that could be trimmed from this. And it is just an example of kind of like bad, bad reality competition making, because the stakes aren't that interesting, because really nobody kind of, I don't know, again, I went into this expecting to see a load of silly dogs doing stupid things, but instead they've trained them on how to do every one of the tasks. And then the sob stories come thick and fast right from the first episode, you know, with tears about how their dog got them through this very difficult time in their life. Mm. And really, I just want to see the dog do something stupid. Yes. Like that's the whole point of the show. When it is at its best is like when they're, you know, they're doing talking head interviews, which are all overproduced and incredibly annoying. And then the dog does something off script. And then it is kind of funny. But I watched two episodes of this and it was, I just could not forgive how bizarre the whole concept was, to have this massive multi-million dollar production for like a dog, you know, a simple dog competition shot in 12 or like 10 different countries, and for it somehow to be still this boring is unforgivable.
Yeah, and did the dogs actually do anything in terms of, you know, the challenges, or are they just there while the owners do that?
The dogs do, so the dogs do a lot in, there's kind of two challenges in each episode. Right in the beginning, they split the group of 12 into two groups of six. And they have a group challenge where everybody has to complete the thing. And in those things, they do things like, well, they go zip lining and they go and they go in searching for various different things. And for that, they train the dogs to recognize a specific scent, and they sort of douse whatever they're looking for in that scent. And then in the individual challenges, they kind of tailor them to where they are. So, for example, in the Mexican episode in Mexico City, because dogs in Mexico are used in earthquake relief, they simulate an earthquake sort of disaster zone, and the dogs have to find people in the rubble. And I mean, that sounds like it's going to be good, but somehow in the production of this, they have made it incredibly boring, because they add in like slow-mo and they build up, they hype up every single thing to the nth degree of hype that it can never hope to live up to it. And it's all just like, it's all just a little bit American. It's all just a bit annoying, and you can't but be a bit cynical when watching this. And really, you just want to see the dogs do kind of stupid stuff, and there's not enough of that by any means.
And on that note of cynicism, given this is on Amazon Prime Video, there's, and this might be something, you know, we're going to see more of in the future, there's like a tie-in now with the Amazon website to buy stuff.
Now, that is only if you watch it on the internet, we'll say. It's not if you're watching it on an app, or at least not that I'm aware of. But if you're watching it on the computer, or like on a computer screen, we'll say, there is an option when you go onto it to like find various different tie-in things, which is basically anything on the Amazon site that is for dogs, right? Because this is for dog lovers and people who are interested in dogs and families, etc. And it's where you can buy any number of things for your prized pup to have them looking, you know, just like the characters. And even they dress up all of the participants and the dogs in little costumes for each challenge that they take part in as well. And it's all like, you know, it's all just a big money-making scheme.
Really. Aren't they all? Right, we'll go to our third show of the day. It's called Song Exploder. Volume 1 is now streaming on Netflix. Here's your clip.
Losing my religion is kind of a mistake. The fact that it became what it became is still puzzling to all of us. That's me in the spot. I don't mind being famous. It's not that bad.
There you go. That's Song Exploder. All episodes of that are streaming now on Netflix. I don't know if you ever saw Classic Albums, James, but it was kind of a series where, you know, there'd be a guy sitting in a studio saying, you know, this is how we added all the bits to various songs and layered it and put it together. Is it kind of like that?
It's very much like that. I would say the kind of pedigree behind this is that Song Exploder will probably be known to many of your listeners because it's a very famous podcast. I think it's been, you know, well, I'm not sure what the verb for podcasting is, but it's on. It's been available to download for about 5-6 years. And it was originally hosted by Hrishikesh Hirway, who is also hosting this, but he is no longer hosting the podcast. He's just executive producing it. And what was sort of, I guess, quite interesting about that podcast right at the very beginning is that despite it being his show, he almost features, I mean, he features very, very little in any of the episodes. He gets people, musicians, to talk about the, you know, a single song that they've produced that they think might be their single best one. And he sort of just has a very good natural way of getting them to open up and talk at great length about it. And it's an excellent podcast, and it's beautifully sort of audio, you know, it's beautiful audio editing and how it's designed, and it's a really pleasant thing to listen to. And there have been a few attempts to turn, you know, podcasts into TV shows that I've talked about on this slot. And I would say by a mile, this is the most successful transition I've ever seen. But it's also because a lot of the other ones have been, you know, audio dramas to serialized dramas or just kind of, you know, like true crime stuff that we don't need more of. Whereas this is slightly more kind of made for this kind of broadcast as well. So this time around, there's only 4 episodes. You get one with Alicia Keys talking about 3 Hour Drive, one with Lin-Manuel Miranda with Wait For It from Hamilton, REM, as we heard in the clip, talking about Losing My Religion, and Ty Dolla Sign talking about LA. And there are 4 more to come in mid-December. And I think one of the challenges and one of the ways it's kind of elevated from the podcast is that, for example, with the Alicia Keys episode, they had filmed a lot of their production of the song. So you have like literal video footage of them making the song, which, you know, which adds to the visual medium that you wouldn't get if you were listening to it as a podcast. But it's still beautifully edited and very stylish to watch. At 25 minutes, the episodes are perfect. I found this like a real perfect thing to have on if you're washing the dishes or you're, you know, you're ironing the clothes or something. Like, you don't need you don't need to give it every second of your attention, but it is great sort of background TV to have. And I really mean that as a compliment. I'm not damning that. I just thought it was very well judged, nice, you know, nice, good TV, and well worth tuning in for.
Is there enough to talk about in that 25 minutes? Is it just specifically about the song, or does it sort of branch into other areas of conversation?
Well, they give obviously an introduction to who all of the artists are, so you get a bit of a history of that. But it's not necessarily just the artists. Like, take with the Alicia Keys episode, it's more of a duet with this British guy named Sampha, and the song is, you know, took place after she had given birth to her, I think, her second child, and shortly after his mother had passed away. And they talk about how, in the kind of writing of the melody and writing of the lyrics, they came to this realization that it was a song about sort of motherhood from the two different sides of motherhood, being a child and being a mother. And you get this great kind of conversation separately, that, you know, each person is interviewed one on one. But you get this great concept of kind of like how the creative process worked for that song. Then in the Lin-Manuel Miranda one, you learn about him on the stage and his attempts to write like Hamilton over, I think, 5-6 years, and how he would record himself walking down the street and email it to his producers. And then it brings in his producers who talk about how they taught it to the cast or various tweaks that they would have made to it, and how, you know, they would have added in breaths here and so on and so forth. It just is, you know, it kind of marries very well the technical aspects of music production along with the creative aspects. So yeah, it's more than just the one person, really. I mean, it's quite far reaching, even though it's only about one piece, if you get me.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. James Dempsey, thanks a million.
Cheers, thank you.
TV. On the radio.
Roll it there, Colette.
Hey, how you doing?
Bazinga.
Well, I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition.
One for everybody in the audience.
It's going to be legendary.
You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.